Hey Trailblazers, this is Jason, your host of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. Before we jump into our latest episode, I've got some incredible news for you. Are you gearing up for your next big hike or backpacking trip? Well, we at Trailblazing Texas podcast have partnered up with Trekker Joe's, the ultimate Texas outfitter, to bring you something I feel absolutely special. Listeners, you of the Trailblazing Texas podcast can now get a one-time 15% off their gear purchases at Trekker Joe's. That's right. Whether you're a first-time customer at Trekker Joe's or a repeat customer like me, you can save big and hit the trails well-prepared. So upon checkout, use code TTP15 to claim your 15% discount and in the process support an amazing local Texas business. So happy trails, and don't forget to tell your hiking buddies. Now on with the episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast, where we embark on a journey through our diverse Texas landscapes and breathtaking trails while always engaging with our amazing Texas hiking community. So settle in, tighten up those bootlaces, and get ready for the thrilling tales awaiting for you on this episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast. I'm your host, Jason. And today we have our very first state natural area coming to the podcast, coming all the way from Government Canyon State Natural Area. We have Nick. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi there. How are you doing today?
Good, good. And because you are the first state natural area, we're going to celebrate and we're just going to jump right in with the lightning round. So to the listeners, and probably new to Nick, Nick hasn't seen any of these questions, and they're just rapid, you know, fast as you can answer, first word that pops into your mind. This is probably my favorite part of the podcast, so if you're ready, we'll just dive right in.
Let's do it.
Favorite trail in the park?
Twin Oaks, no doubt.
Funniest thing you've ever heard a visitor say?
Man. Usually it has to do with where our animals are. What do we do with our animals? Because they didn't see it.
So are you a sunrise hiker or a sunset sitter?
More a sunrise hiker than any.
So what do you think is louder, a trail full of unsupervised kids or a trail full of dinosaurs?
Unsupervised kids.
If this was your last day at the park, what message would you leave behind for future park staff?
And the importance of making sure that people connect to this place.
So what is your go-to hiking snack?
Go-to hiking snack. I usually don't take a lot of snacks out.
All right. Coolest animal you've ever spotted at the park?
Porcupine. Definitely my favorite to watch.
Favorite time of day in the park?
Sunrise.
Most important thing first timers coming to the park should know before arriving?
Plan your route and bring more water.
Nice. What's more dangerous, raccoons near the campfire or toddlers with a marshmallow stick?
That's a close one. since I have a 10-year-old boy, I'm going to say the toddler.
What's one moment that reminded you why you love working there?
You know, it's not really one moment. It's any time you have a young person or a newcomer, somebody who comes out to this place and you kind of see the light bulb go off, where they realize why this place is so important, why this place is so special.
All right. Yes or no? Have you ever answered a visitor's question that made you pause and think, did they just really ask that?
I used to. After so many years, not as much anymore, but yes.
What part of the park do you hope never changes?
The whole place. The goal is that the entire, well, mostly the backcountry area, but the goal is that in another 100 years, someone comes out here and sees the backcountry and it has not changed.
So what would you tell a brand new park ranger starting there for their very first day?
Pace yourself. The work list, you never get to the bottom of the project list. You can't get it all done in one day. Pace yourself. Pay attention to the surroundings that you get to work in. And don't lose sight of the incredible fortune you have to work in a place like this.
So, do you have a trail snack that you pretend to like but secretly hate?
No, I do not.
I have that on the trail is beef jerky. I love beef jerky, but I don't like to eat it on the trail. And it seems like that's every hiker that I'm with, that's their go-to. And I'm just like, yeah, not on the trail.
Yeah, I've taken on trail before, but same deal. Like whenever I'm, you know, hot and moving through the woods and I need something that's crisp and refreshing, and jerky just doesn't do it.
So what does the park mean to you, not as a job, but just as a place in your life?
So the Government Canyon being a natural area, it's all about recharge. We were set aside to protect a portion of the Edwards Aquifer Recharge Zone, but being an urban wilderness area, we're also set aside to help people recharge themselves, disconnect, immerse yourself in a wild environment, immerse yourself in nature, and you get to really just recharge yourself. And that, I think that's an important part.
I like that. So would you rather clean the park restrooms after a busy holiday weekend or lead a group of 20 unsupervised fifth graders on a hike?
You know, honestly, it would both be fun. There are days where you are mentally exhausted from leading large groups or coordinating a lot of different projects, where it's kind of nice to just put in your earbuds, go grab your mop and clean the restroom. So
yeah,
it depends.
All right. Would you rather deal with a drone flying influencer who's ignoring all the signs or a camper blaring country music at 6 a.m.?
I would rather deal with the camper because I'm partial to country music. I'll at least enjoy the music while I talk.
All right. So last question, and this is the most important question, and this really dictates, I don't know if you've listened to previous episodes, this dictates how long the episode lasts. So what is your favorite Texas hiking podcast?
Man, I'm going to have to say Trailblazing Texas is my favorite hiking podcast.
We are going to continue that. You know, it's funny, all the guests on the podcast, they answer the same, and man, it's as a podcaster, it's exciting to hear. So thank you for that one.
Absolutely.
So as we dive into this episode, I think it's important for me to have the listeners get to know a bit about you. So kind of the first question, how long have you worked for, I guess, Texas Parks and Wildlife?
I'm coming up on 17 years. I hired on full-time January of 2009. And before that, I did two summer internships with agency as well.
Oh, wow. So how long have you been at Government Canyons?
This is my second stint. I'm close to about 10 years at Government Canyon.
So as the site superintendent, what does a typical day look like for you?
And the only typical day is there is no typical day. I come in the morning, usually knock out as many emails as I can, then go touch base with any of my staff that are around. If someone needs help in the field, I'll go help with projects, from helping mend fence to weed eating to helping clean something, you name it. This morning I coordinated some rental equipment that we had used to move a large boulder last week. Rental company had to come pick it up, so I had to help coordinate that this morning. So there's not really a typical day.
So what inspired you to get into, you know, working with parks?
I would say that a little bit of growing up. So I didn't really aspire to be a park ranger when I was little. I did spend a lot of time outdoors with my family. We spent a lot of time camping, a lot of time at the lake. And then in college, I actually changed majors. I started as a poli-sci history double major. Then through my experiences in college, graduated as a geography, resource environmental studies, and geology minor. So I went to school in San Marcos, Texas, beautiful campus, river running right through there, very environmentally conscious community. And just being involved in the community and doing some volunteer work, giving back, helping clean the river, helping educate folks. I realized I liked that. I did a lot of volunteer work in college in Texas State Parks as well. Learned kind of what park rangers do, and that changed my whole trajectory.
So what's your favorite part of the job?
Really, I enjoy talking to the visitors more than anything. One of the things that I do, we have multiple different jobs in Texas State Parks. One of them is called a customer service representative. That's usually the person who greets you and takes your fees or swipes your park pass whenever you arrive. Being shorthanded, as most sites are, I end up working that front entrance booth position pretty frequently. I get to know our regulars, get to know why they come out here, what they like about this place. And building those community relations is really, really an enjoyable part of the job.
So what do you think one thing about your job is that might surprise people?
The amount of things that we fix in-house. So we don't get to, whenever something breaks, we don't always get to call a plumber, call an electrician, call a mechanic. We do all of it. So a lot of folks think of park rangers as, you know, oh, that's great. You get to spend all your time outdoors and walking the trails. And just like they feel like we're out there hiking just like they would be. And we do get to do that. But we spend a lot of time fixing things, cleaning things, and doing paperwork behind the scenes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and I've never really paid attention to until recently the difference between a state park and a state natural area. And so what I gathered is state parks are primarily focused on recreation and kind of public enjoyment. So, you know, what I tend to see is they offer a wide range of activities. Versus the state natural area is more of a conservation and to protect the natural resources.
That's pretty close. So a lot of natural areas also offer those opportunities. The big difference is statutory. So there's a definition of a state park versus a state natural area. State natural areas are set aside specifically to protect a resource of statewide significance. If you think about some of the more popular state natural areas, it's really easy to kind of wrap your head around it. Lost Maple has those beautiful big tooth maple trees that are kind of unique for that area. Enchanted Rock is a very unique batholith, big exfoliation dome out there that sticks up and is a unique resource. Government Canyon is protecting the Edwards Aquifer Recharge Zone. So that's a very significant source of water for the city of San Antonio. But the aquifer itself is a very unique aquifer, really anywhere in the world. So as a state natural area, we're set aside to protect that resource and provide educational opportunities. So we still do a lot of the same stuff, but whenever you go to a state natural area, you're not going to see as much of a built environment. You're going to see minimal facilities. You're going to see a lot of trails. You're going to see a lot of wilderness area.
So what do you think makes Government Canyon stand out from other natural areas in Texas?
Partially the size. So Government Canyon is 13,000 acres. It's pretty large. It's hard to really see that since we are in the city limits of San Antonio. The majority of the property, all but about maybe 1,000 acres might be outside the city limits, but the rest has been annexed in and it's inside the city of San Antonio. You just can't find urban wilderness preserve like this anywhere else.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. So when I'm 52, so when I turned 50, my wife asked me, you know, what do I want to do for my 50th birthday? And I said, well, I've got 18 state parks and we got about 8 days. I wanted to go and check them out. So we did it. And I can, you know, Government Canyons was certainly on the list. And I can remember driving down and it was almost like I'm in a neighborhood. I was literally like, yeah, let's just turn around. But when I got to the park, I was like, oh my, you would never, to the listeners, if you've never been, you will never imagine the beauty that you're going to see at this place. And yes, it's, you know, you're driving by a neighborhood or maybe even, I can't remember, into the neighborhood and then you make a turn. It's incredible. So yeah, that was my experience with Government Canyons. And it was amazing, amazing place for sure.
So inside of that, you know, there's the days aspect also, but you know, you can go camping in a natural area and while you're inside the property in the interior, you do feel like, you know, you're disconnected from the urban environment. But if you forget something, you can get to Walmart in about 5-10 minutes and then be back in your wilderness setting.
That's crazy. So what do you think are some of the park's conservation priorities?
Right. So our biggest project that we work on continuously is our Savannah Restoration Program. So we have 4 different identified units where we're actively trying to combat invasive species, mitigate woody brush species, and really encourage a growth of native grasses and some oak and some other hardwood trees, but mostly restoring that post-oak savanna ecosystem. That's probably going to be our project we work on a regular basis.
Can you explain, how do you manage the balance between being a public resource, but also trying to protect this natural space?
Yeah, that's the $62 million question. Really, it's by education and careful design. So whenever you design trails, whenever you design natural areas, parks even these days, we design kind of where we want the heavy use to be, where the lighter use would be. We do intentionally leave areas unutilized, left aside to kind of be left wild and natural. At Government Canyon, one of the things we do in many state parks and natural areas, we have capacity limits. We have created, whenever we were built, we had a set number of parking spaces, and those parking spaces kind of help determine how busy we can be. When we're full, we're full. And that kind of helps balance that out. We still are able to let a lot of people in. They can come on our 40 miles of trail spread out. Depending on what trail they're on, they can feel like they're completely alone, or they can feel like every other person at the natural area is on the same trail with them if they're going to see the dinosaur tracks, for example. But really, the design and the parking, the suggestions we give visitors when they show up, it really helps balance that all out.
So to the listeners, he did say dinosaur tracks, and we'll get into that here in a second. And that's what allured me to Government Canyons. I was like, no way, there's dinosaur tracks. Yeah, there are.
Oh, yeah.
So are there any areas of the park that's not open to the public?
We do have quite a few acres that are not open to the public. Government Canyon has been slowly growing since the first 4,700 acres were acquired in 1993. I don't want to get too deep into history because now we're going to do that later. But from that 4,700 acres in 93, we've grown to 13,000. And not the entire property has not been master planned yet. Some of those properties were acquired with funds and some were donated. So there's several different funding strings, several different acquisition strategies, conservation easements, public-private partnerships. It's a very diverse tract of land. And there's areas that will be open to the public in the future, and there's some areas that will be left aside because they're mitigation or they're some type of protected habitat.
So this is an interesting question, especially for as long as you've been at the park. How have you seen visitation change over the past few years?
So when I started here, 2009, 2010, 2011, that time frame, visitation was pretty slow. We knew about the dinosaur tracks, but we didn't publicize them because we really didn't know much more than there's these cool tracks here. And that was about as far as it went. It wasn't until, I want to say it was 2017, roundabout. I'd have to go double check the date. But we entered a partnership with the Woody Museum in downtown San Antonio. They came out and studied our tracks and told us what they were and helped us with educational material. And we started advertising. And since then, I think back then we were in the maybe 20, 30,000 visitation range, maybe 40 on the high end. Now we're upwards of 80. And I think this last year we surpassed 84,000 visitors in 1 year. So we had the COVID spike like everybody else did. And we've come down a little bit from that, but not much. Because as that COVID spike started going back down, we've had homes building around our boundaries at a lightning speed. So we have more neighbors here than we've ever had. And I think that's another big factor is just we are really a neighborhood park for a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's crazy, you know, to see how people right there in San Antonio, 5-10 minute walk from your house that I would be out there every single day.
Yeah. Yeah, we do have a lot of regulars that we see every day we're open.
All right. So let's get into the dinosaur tracks. Tell us of the story behind that. So they're there, it's a natural area, then all of a sudden someone discovered it, and like, whoa.
Yeah, so whenever we acquired the property in 93, we knew there were tracks there. The ranch foreman previously had mentioned it. We went and checked them out. But, you know, something interesting about dinosaur tracks. Within our agency, we have our natural resource program and our cultural resource program. We don't really have a program for dinosaur tracks. They kind of fall in an in-between zone. So we partner with other organizations on dinosaur tracks. We have two types of dinosaur tracks out here. They're very similar to the ones you would see at Dinosaur Valley State Park in Glen Rose, Texas. As a matter of fact, they are in Glen Rose Limestone. It's that same geologic formation that you have in Glen Rose, Texas. That's why it's named as such. But the two dinosaurs are Acrocanthosaurus. That's the three-toed theropod dinosaur. Looks kind of like a T-Rex for reference. A little bit smaller, a little bit older, but similar type dinosaur. And then you've got the Sauroposeidon. It's a sauropod. Basically has elephant-type feet. And it mostly resembles what most people would consider like a brontosaurus-type dinosaur, just for visual sake. Visually also similar to the Paluxosaur, which is what you have out there at Dinosaur Valley State Park. The tracks are about 104 million years old. In a couple months here, Government Canyon is turning 20. So we like to say that the tracks are 104 million and 20 years old now. Couldn't resist.
So are the tracks accessible to all visitors or only certain times a year?
Sure. So they are accessible to most visitors as long as you can get 2.5 miles out and 2.5 miles back. So it is a hike. It is not something you just drive up to, hop out, take a picture, and hop back in your car. It's a minimum 5-mile round-trip hike to see the tracks. It's a 6-mile hike if you also do the overlook. There's a 60-foot cliff right above the tracks, and so you can see them from literally from a bird's eye view. That makes the track, the hike, 6 miles. If we've had a lot of rain, then it is likely the tracks are underwater, and then it takes time for the water to evaporate and for us to go clean out the mud and any kind of organic material that is settled into the tracks. But outside of that, they're viewable any day that we're open to the public.
I think that's the route that I did. Went to the dinosaur tracks and then did the overlook. And to the listeners, if you haven't been out there, get out there because it's spectacular. I don't know that there's a lot of state parks and natural areas that have such a cool thing, dinosaur tracks. Is there even a way to preserve these?
To an extent. So we have put up little barricades around them to discourage people. They, I mean, you could step over them if you really wanted to, but it keeps honest people honest. But we've put delineated an area where we ask people not to step inside to at least preserve the tracks a little bit from any non-natural weathering and deterioration. Now, anytime we have a flood event or rain event, wind, moving around sand, things like that, predominantly just really flood events, they do modify our tracks. And in my tenure at Government Canyon, I've seen the track shift a couple times. We've lost a few. We've discovered new ones. Sandbars have shifted and covered up some nice tracks, and they've shifted and uncovered other tracks. So It's always changing. There are likely a lot more tracks there than what we're seeing. And in the next 10, 20 years, the trackway may be a little bit different. But there's a few that will probably always be there.
So to the listeners, no ussies with the dinosaur tracks. Stay behind the barricades.
Well, because of that, we do have one cast. So I mentioned we worked with the Witte Museum, right?
Right.
If you go into the Witte and you walk into the Great Hall, right behind the desk where they take your money, there's a giant Acrocanthosaurus skeleton. It's just right there, right when you walk in. And that skeleton is stepping out of a footprint that's left in the mud. That is a cast of one of our tracks. That same cast we have up at the visitor center right outside the door. And it's underneath an informational panel where you can put your foot in it, take a picture, all sorts of stuff.
All right, nice. What is your favorite little known geological feature in the park?
So I enjoy the change that you encounter going up the Bluff Spurs. So if you take we have the North Bluff Spur and the South Bluff Spur, and collectively we call it the Bluff Spurs Trail. You can turn it into a loop, but the most common hike is to go from the headquarters up to the South Bluff Spur and then double back. It's a 3-mile hike. You get to an overlook. It's fairly shaded. So climbing up that trail, you start down kind of in the Blackland Prairie area. You go down the Recharge Trail, which follows the Hades Crossing Fault Line, which is a significant fault, and the Balcones Fault Zone, which essentially delineates the Blackland Prairie from the Balcones Escarpment. It's where the stair steps start kind of right along that fault zone. So you walk along that fault zone, and you start climbing up into the escarpment. And as you climb up, you see a lot of different chunks of exposed limestone. And a lot of it has chert nodules, flint, but chert nodules that are sticking out from the rocks. And it's raw material that the Native Americans would have used to make arrowheads, points, knives, scrapers, all things, all sorts of tools. As you continue to go up, there's a few imprints of fossilized shells also along the way on that trail. So there's just a couple of cool little hidden gems, and the transition is what I like to see.
All right. It's really important that the visitors understand what it means to plan a trip to the park. And so, like you mentioned earlier, time park entrances. So what is the best way for visitors to, I'm guessing that they need to plan ahead of time, reserve day passes and all that sort of thing, instead of, kind of just showing up the day of?
It depends on the time of year. So we always recommend, as soon as you know you want to come out, go ahead and make that reservation online. It makes the check-in process a lot faster. One of our volunteer park hosts who works at Fee Booth for us kind of in the fall and winter time actually went in one day and counted the number of clicks on the screen it takes. So someone who shows up without a reservation, we have to click in 11 different places on the screen in order to check them in and get them on their way. If someone who has a reservation, sometimes it's just two. Click, click, you're checked in. You've already printed out your permit. Here's your map. If you have any questions, have a nice day. So it's that quick. We tend to sell out in the morning time frame when the temperatures start dropping into the 70s. So we're not there yet. Still pretty hot. We do get crowds come out, but not like we do in the fall and winter. Those really are busy months out here.
For camping, do you guys offer any backcountry campsites, or is it all front country?
It's all front country, I would call it a primitive front country experience, which sounds kind of counterintuitive. The sites themselves are walk-in sites. You don't have your own, you can't drive up to the campsite, but it's a short walk-in. You have a picnic table, you have a fire ring. There's no water or electricity at the site, but the campground restroom is a full-service shower house restroom with electricity, and there are water spigots all around the parking. So it's kind of a best of both worlds, which I think is very well suited for our urban environment.
And for our hiking and backpackers, you said the park has 40 miles worth of trail currently?
40 miles. That's correct.
Wow. So that could really keep someone busy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The outer loop is a full day hike, at least for me.
So what would you say are the most popular hiking trails and why?
So without a doubt, the hike to the dinosaur tracks, because of the dinosaur tracks. After that, Far Reaches, because there's a couple of nice overlooks out there. And then whenever people go up Far Reaches, they tend to either come down Wildcat or Sendero. We highly recommend Wildcat just because it has a lot of shade. It's a nice way to kind of cool down for part of your hike. Those are probably going to be the most popular in the backcountry. And then our front country trails are probably even more popular than that, just because they're a little more accessible. It's Lytle's Loop and Savannah Loop. They're a little bit flatter, 7 miles total. They're pet friendly. So we have a lot of people out there in the front country all the time.
And so what trails would you recommend for families like with young kids that, maybe can't make the 5 mile loop to see the dinosaur tracks?
I usually start out with one or two trails. There's the Discovery Trail, which is right here at the Visitor Center. It's 1.25 miles. It has informational waysides along the way, some identification markers talking about a little different things about the natural area. There's benches along the way. And also, it is our only surface trail. It's a surface of decomposed granite, and so it's mostly accessible. So it's stroller-friendly. It's wagon-friendly. It's a nice little trail. The next step up from that would be Savannah Loop, which is 2 miles, but it's natural surface trail.
And so what would you say is, if I want to get out just solitude, don't want to see anybody, what is the trail for me?
Man, if you don't want to see anybody, let's see, you'll want to go up Joe Johnson, up Wildcat Canyon, and then probably go north towards Twin Oaks. And that route right there will probably be a pretty good route. Now, when you hit the Joe Johnson coming back, you can't avoid it. That is our super highway trail. But up and down on the back side of Wildcat and Twin Oaks, you'll probably be mostly by yourself. Now, in the middle of the winter, our protected habitat area is open. There, it's open 6 months out of the year, starting, September. We'll open up the ProHab. And up there, you're looking at an 8 miles round trip just to get to the gate of the ProHab. So you don't even go in it. Just go to the gate, turn around, and come back. You're looking at a minimum 8 miles. So it's a long hike. So you don't run into nearly as many people up there in the protected habitat when it's open.
I know my favorite, my heaven on earth, my favorite park in the world. If you said right now, Jason, I will pay for your next 100 backpacking trips, 99 would be at this place, and it's Guadalupe Mountains.
Oh, yeah.
And it's because the solitude. Like, I've been there 25 times, found all the hidden gems. And, you know, the areas now that I'm usually at on every backpacking trip, it's in the backcountry. And, like, I don't see anybody the whole trip. And so you really feel like the whole park is mine. And it's incredible. So,
yeah, I'm right there with you. I was planning a trip in September, but I'm going to have to go to a conference instead. So I may get out there in November, December timeframe, get back up to McKittrick Canyon. It's just can't beat it.
Have you done Permian Reef Trail yet?
No, that was on my next trip. I was planning to get out there and try that one. When I went out last, it was with my family, and we could only do a couple of trails. So we were doing Guadalupe's and Carlsbad in the same trip.
Oh, nice. I think for the most bang for your buck, if you want to experience the park, it's either McKittrick or Permian Reef. And I would probably vote Permian Reef because you get up, it's an easier up to elevation. And you know, you experience the cliffs and all that stuff. But yeah, if you need any, you want to talk Guadalupe or have any, hey, what trails you recommend, just hit me up.
Sounds good.
I had no idea that birding was such a huge thing here in Texas. So are there any wildlife viewing opportunities in the park for our birder listeners or photographers?
Oh, yeah. So San Antonio, you know, is in one of the fly zones during migration. So we get different birds coming through here all the time. Government Canyon is actually listed as an important birding area. And we have a very healthy population every year of golden cheek warblers. We do fairly frequently get sightings of, I wouldn't say frequently, but we do get sightings of black-capped vireos. And a lot of people come here specifically to see either golden cheek warblers, black-capped vireos, or painted buntings. And the buntings are so thick right now, like I've got to avoid them when I drive in to the office. They just like to sit in the middle of the road and play chicken. And they're beautiful birds. But we've got a lot of good variety. Up around the visitor center, we have a whiteboard where people can jot down birds they've seen just right there at the bird bath of the visitor center. We don't currently have any wildlife viewing stations like bird blinds, most people call them. We're working on installing at least one, but the birding out here is just great. Come out in the morning. That Savannah Loop Trail that I mentioned earlier. So it's part of it goes through a wooded area with a canopy and little breaks in the canopy where edge birds like to dart around. You can see a lot of birds through there. And then another section of the trail borders that Savannah restoration area I was talking about. So you can see more raptors and other birds that like to fly back and forth. We have kestrels out here all the time. Watching a kestrel hunt is a whole other experience. Crested caracaras, tanagers. So yeah, it's a great place to go birding.
So this is probably a dumb question, but what is the best season to come visit the park? And I pretty much guess you're not going to say summer.
That is correct. any time other than summer is the best time to come out here. Now, the summer is not bad. If you come out early, do a quick hike and get out of here, it's gorgeous because it's not going to be very busy. Get those nice sunrises, get in and out. But if you want to spend the day here, the wintertime is the time to come. So wait till those temperatures drop into the 70s and come enjoy it. Just bring lots of water.
I have an opinion on this and I will keep it to myself. But so are dogs allowed on the trails?
They are allowed in our front country area. So they're allowed on Lytle's Loop and Savannah Loop. That front country for us is defined as not over the Edwards Aquifer recharge zone. And that is the reason that they are not allowed in the back country, is our whole purpose, as we mentioned earlier, natural area, is to protect that water quality and quantity over the Edwards Aquifer recharge zone.
All right. So with the amount of people that come visit the park, and you're right next to, you know, these neighborhoods, so are there any leave no trace challenges that you think are unique to the park?
You would think we would have more problems with trash on our trails, but Government Canyon's been unique for a very long time. But we have been very fortunate that you just don't find a lot of trash on our trails. Now, as visitation picked up over the last 5 to 10 years, it's increased a little bit, but it's usually small amounts. A lot of our visitors pick up trash as they hike. We have a lot of volunteers out here, armies of volunteers that help us maintain our trails. They pick up trash. The micro trash is really the biggest problem right now, and food trash. So banana peels, orange peels, things that people would typically throw out the window and say, oh, it'll biodegrade, it's fine. Those are the things that we really have the most trouble with.
Hopefully most of the listeners know, like, just carry it out. It's not going right. to decompose, especially like in the guads and stuff. You always see orange peels and stuff. Yeah, that if you were under an orange tree, absolutely, you want to throw a peel out in the backcountry for sure.
Right.
So, how should visitors prepare before coming out, especially like new hikers?
Talk to the rangers. Study the map. Talk to one of us. Call us up. Ask. We also keep a map. We have a stack of maps up at the front desk and also at the fee booth that have a whole bunch of routes highlighted. And we have them organized by mileage. And we have hikes with the Prohab included and without the Prohab. If you're looking to do, you know, 2 to 3 miles, we have a couple suggestions. If you're looking for 6 to 8 miles, we have some other suggestions. We can recommend what direction to hike, because none of our trails are directional. They're all bidirectional. We can offer tips on stuff to see while you're on the trail. So just talk to the rangers when you're planning your hike. Be very wary of third-party trail apps. While they're very beneficial and they definitely have a place, you'll want to ground truth them against the actual park map and with the ranger particularly. The best example I have for that right now is currently on Google Maps. We're trying to get this resolved. Apparently, a couple of people took a shortcut where there is no trail, and now Google thinks there's a trail there. So we've actually had one person get lost because of that. So definitely call ahead, ground truth, ask some questions, and that's the best way to prepare for a hike out here.
And take plenty of water.
Oh, God, yes. Always.
Is that y'all's biggest issue?
It really is. I'd say the majority of our rescues where staff have to get involved or first responders outside of Parks and Wildlife, like our local fire or police, the number one thing we have to help people with is heat-related emergencies. We had 6 last weekend.
6? Wow.
Yeah, 6 people, 3.
So speaking of that, is there cell service throughout the park, or is there certain areas that you know the listeners need to be leery of that it's iffy?
It's pretty hit or miss. It depends. So the major carriers, at least from my experience, from observation, some of the major carriers, AT&T, Verizon, you're going to get signals out there most places. You're not going to get signals when you're down in a valley, down between 2 hills, where you just don't have a good line of sight with the cell towers. But we do have pretty good coverage out here. And even if you can't get coverage, for the most part, most phones these days will go into SOS mode. So if you need to call 911, your phone will hit whatever tower it can hit and call 911. There's even a few that'll do satellite calling now. So just be familiar with the workings of your phone, what it does in emergency mode. I've learned that in SOS mode, a lot of times your phone will not be able to pinpoint your location nearly as accurately as if you were hitting a couple of different cell towers. So you want to make sure you know where you are at all times. Look at the map every once in a while. So if you do have to call 911, you can give the dispatcher in the few seconds before you lose signal. You can let them know who you are, where you are, and what you need. And that's the most important thing.
What are the biggest challenges that you have in managing a park?
Man, all of them. the balancing maintenance, visitor services, and the administrative side of things. That's always the biggest challenge. You want to make sure people are having a great experience. So you want to put a lot of time and effort into your educational programming, aesthetics, things like clean bathrooms, you know, all those things. But you also have to spend a lot of time on the back end, making sure things are purchased, reports are filed, personnel is managed appropriately. And trying to do all that to the best of your ability is can be taxing. That's the biggest challenge, is just time management.
Oh, I bet. So I know we kind of touched on some of them, but can we talk in more detail about some of the conservation projects you guys are getting involved in and that are what are important to you?
Sure. So let's see, there's a kind of a newer one that one of my resource specialists is working on that's studying barking frogs. If you've not heard of a barking frog, that's okay, because I hadn't either until fairly recently. But it's a small frog that it sounds like a dog barking. And they tend to enjoy areas that are near cave openings. And we have quite a few karst features out here. And that just means there's fissures, sinkholes, caves, openings that open down into the Ebers Aquifer. These frogs like those areas. And we have a couple of different species that we monitor as an analog for aquifer health. And that's a new one that we've added. So we're going to be doing surveys and keeping up with the population of those little critters to help us keep up with the health of the aquifer, at least in our general area. So that's a fun one that I enjoy. Another one that I've got an intern working on right now is Johnson grass, which is an invasive species of grass. A Johnson grass removal process that utilizes basically plastic. You cover up the grass with plastic, wet it down a little bit first, and you essentially cook it to help kill the rhizomes and actually kill the Johnson grass. It's very tough to kill it. So those are two right now.
This is and it just popped in my mind. You know, you guys are right next to these subdivisions and stuff. Do you guys have any worry that of all the chemicals and fertilizers that people put in their yard and then all the runoff, like how that impacts you guys?
A little bit, yes. I mean, there's always that concern. A lot of the neighborhoods that have been built recently are kind of downstream from us, so to speak. And the neighborhoods, the way they're building them these days, we have very few houses on the southern half of Government Canyon that are right up against our fence. They build the neighborhood, and I'm going to use very generalizations here. I don't want to be accusing anybody of anything, but they tend to have more drainage issues. And so the way you see these designs is they bring in a lot of material, lift the whole area where they're going to be building the houses. Then they lift the houses up beyond that, so the driveways are all at an angle. And they run the storm drainage in the neighborhood. A lot of times goes around the outer perimeter of the neighborhood. And so a lot of our boundary, we have storm drains now. So all that runoff goes down and away from the natural area for the most part. We haven't had any issues with it yet.
And so when you all have these conservation projects, is there a way that the public can get involved or support you guys in these?
Yes, absolutely. So Government Canyon has a very healthy volunteer program. Anybody who wants to get involved in volunteering at Government Canyon is super easy. We have a volunteer opportunity. If you go to the Parks and Wildlife webpage, up at the top, you'll see a tab that says volunteer. Then you go down and type in San Antonio. And we're the only one in state park, state natural area in San Antonio. There'll be some other opportunities in the area, but you'll find San Antonio and you'll find one that says first time volunteer. You sign up for that one. It gets you in the queue. Once your background check is cleared, you'll be reached out to by Lindsay, Ryan, or Lisa, and they will help get you signed, locked into interpretive programming volunteering, trailhead advisor volunteering, resource program, maintenance program, all sorts of stuff. So there's lots of opportunities.
All right. And what about like financially, like just donations in general? And the reason why I asked is because, you know, I donate to Guadalupe Mountains, and I was shocked that me donating just generally to the parks, the National Park Service, that I couldn't say, I want my money to go here. So I have to, you know, mail Guadalupe Mountains a check. If someone wants to, first off, can they donate to the park? And is there a way, you know, like if they really, their heart is in Government Canyon, like mine is in the Guads, you know, could they make sure that those funds are there to support you guys?
Absolutely. And there's two ways to do that. Many of our state parks and natural areas have a friends group. That's a 50, they're all 501c3 nonprofits that have a memorandum of agreement with Texas Parks and Wildlife as the nonprofit support organization for that site. And Government Canyon has one called the Friends of Government Canyon. That's a whole nother story that I'd love to get into at some point because it's a very unique organization. But if you want funds, anyone who wants funds to stay at a particular site, find the friends group for that site and make the donation to them. And they're able to use that money to support the site. The other way to do it is, like you said, you can earmark donations, send them directly to Parks and Wildlife and say this donation is for X. And that there are some ways you can direct it to a specific site, but you have to specifically put it in there. So it is used for that site.
Okay, cool. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Outside of not carrying enough water, what are some of the most common, it floors me sometimes, but anyway, what are some of the most common mistakes that you see visitors make?
So there's a lot of different reasons to get out on the trail. Mental clarity, enjoying nature. Sometimes people are just trying to get healthy. They're trying to get outside. They're trying to get in shape, you know, and they're like, okay, I'm going to do hiking more so I can drop some pounds so I can tone my muscle, whatever the reason, but they're trying to do it as a workout, which is great. Sometimes people will push themselves a little bit. If you're at the gym, by all means, push yourself, work hard, rest, sit in the AC, get a shower, get some food next to the whatever shop's next door. When you come out into a wilderness area, especially as big as Government Canyon, you have to be careful if you're coming out to get a workout. You need to make sure that you're prepared for that workout. A lot of folks that we run into, besides not just having enough water. So sometimes we get to people, they have plenty of water still. They're not out of water, but maybe they skipped breakfast or all they had was a shake and they haven't really had that shake very many times. So they're not sure how their body's going to react to it yet. Maybe they had not been pre-hydrating. So they have plenty of water with them, but over the past few days, they, for whatever reason, did not drink much water, didn't take in many fluids. Maybe had to work a couple of late night shifts and just their rhythm is out of sync. So just making sure you're physically ready to get out on the trail and don't push it. You know, the trails aren't going anywhere. There's no reason to try and hike all the trails all at once. Come out, do a short hike, enjoy it. The more you're physically ready for your hike, the more you're going to be able to enjoy that hike. Because as you start really pushing yourself to the limit, you're going to lose the ability to enjoy the scenery, to enjoy the sights, the sounds, the smells of this place, and you won't get that same experience. So definitely come out, make healthy choices, come get that healthy, those healthy steps in out of Government Canyon, but don't max it out.
I think that's the best advice I've ever heard in my life. And to the listeners, no aspect of your life do you want to test in the backcountry. You know, it's make sure you're in shape to do what you're doing. Don't eat something different on trail or before the trail that you haven't done before. I took, so I'm about an hour south of both endpoints of the longest trail in Texas, the Lone Star Hiking Trail. And I took three people to through hike it. And, you know, day one we're going and these three people didn't really have any backpacking or hiking experience. And this guy is eating these sausages. And so I'm like, oh, cool. And he's asked me, do you want some? And I'm like, I've never eaten that before and I'm not going to do it on trail. And he's like, well, what do you mean? I go, well, you don't know how your body's going to react to this, right? And he's like, yeah, I've never eaten them either. But, you know, someone said they're good trail snacks. That guy, within the first 2 to 3 days, dug more cat holes than, you know, if I had a nickel for every cat hole he had to dig, you know, I'd be retired. So, yeah, that was some great, great advice for sure. How do you envision the park changing over the next 10 years?
Over the next 10 years, I'm expecting we'll expand our operations a little bit. We'll probably add in a few more trails. We may modify some, so we may move some of the locations. I'm working with the planning program. I actually had an email 2 days ago on some of our newer acquisitions of acreage to get public use plans in place and try and add some new experiences that hopefully will include some true backcountry backpacking camping experience opportunities.
So last two questions as we start to kind of wrap up. This is your time to sell the audience of why they should come to Government Canyon Natural Area. So sell us.
Well, man, so some of the stuff I've already said, you know, it's, we are in an urban area. You can get up in the morning, go by your favorite breakfast taco place, get some coffee, keep on driving out, come out to Government Canyon, park, and then all of a sudden you're immersed in a wilderness environment. You can hike out into the trails, pick a route that's going to take you kind of away from people, get some incredible views, take in the sights. Depending on what trail you hike into, you may get to a place where you cannot hear any traffic whatsoever, except maybe a plane flying over, depending on the routes they're doing that day. You'll hear birds that you may not hear in your backyard because of the construction or the noise or the neighbor's radio or whatever. But you can really open up your senses. And you come back, you get off the trail, you take your picture for your Instagram about the crazy, incredible hike you just had with either your friends or by yourself. And then with another 5 minutes, you're back at your favorite lunch spot. There's just nowhere else you can do that. There are places in San Antonio. We have no shortage of trails in San Antonio, but this is one of the best and largest urban wilderness experiences you'll have anywhere. And it's definitely worth seeing.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny you say that. That's the actual next question is what do you wish more people understood about the park? And I can speak from experience that, you know, it's absolutely, if you've never been there, you're driving kind of by or through a neighborhood and it was kind of disheartening. But when you get into the park and you just start on the trails, I don't know how many times in a video I'd looked at my wife and go, can you believe this is here? And how often are you going to come across dinosaur footprints?
It's a unique experience. It really is. It really is. You know, and something else that, you know, strikes me, I mention this every once in a while. So eventually we'll get into one of these discussions. I really love diving into the history of why this, what makes the acquisition of Government Canyon so unique. But the people who started the whole push to set this land aside, the citizens, grassroots efforts, in the 90s, like late 80s, early 90s, had the foresight to see that development was moving this direction. And had they not acted, then this entire acreage would just be like those neighborhoods you drove through and passed on the way in. It would just be another neighborhood. So just trying to wrap your head around that is really hard to do.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-mm-mm. Well, we are finished. And Nick, I greatly appreciate you coming on the podcast again. You know, I say this every time, and I don't know that I ever find the right words to express how grateful I am for sharing all the information, taking time out of your day, because I know you're swamped. I definitely think that the listeners will get a new perspective of Government Canyons. And hopefully if they've never been there, this will be a bucket list item on their next trip.
Absolutely. Glad to share. I can talk about this place forever. There's a reason I've been here as long as I have. I really believe in what this place is about and what the people here are doing. And it's very important. I'd love to share it with everybody.
Absolutely. Well, you have a wonderful rest of your day and we'll be in touch.
Thank you. Likewise.
And that wraps up another exciting episode of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. We hope you enjoyed the episode today and stay tuned for our next episode where we will pick back up where we left off and guarantee to uncover many more hiking gems and share many more tips to enhance your experience on the trail. Until then, happy trails and happy hiking.